Virginia Bush, and my date of birth is 12/15/51.
Oh, you were born the same year I was. I'm 7/16/51. I beat you a little bit. All right, I'm going to re-explain to you, Virginia. I know we just talked about it, but I wanted to sort of start the tape out saying this: the name of this project is Life During the Pandemic in Kentucky. It is an oral history of individuals as they live through the pandemic, and it will be archived at the University of Louisville, and I think yours will probably also be archived at the Oral History Commission. We'll be sending you a release, and it may actually be two releases. It may be a secondary. So you sign one for UofL and one for UK. So that may come in the mail in the next week. So, and I'll have an envelope and send it back to me. So without further ado, let me ask the first question. And that is for you to tell me who you were prior to your knowledge of the gravity of the COVID virus and, you know, what you were doing.
Well, prior to the COVID, I was working as a nurse in long-term care after retiring from the VA. And then I also, of course, am a wife and a mother of four kids. They're kind of spread around the country, but one of them lives here, he and his family. So I've got three grandchildren that are local. And was the health ministry nurse for St. William and La Casita. And probably I do some environmental activism and some on the edges of racial justice work as well.
Yes. I mean, you are, I mean, the social activist, I've seen that in action in the parish. And so I do recognize that you do wonderful, wonderful things for people, social justice, environmental justice. And there are many other things I don't know about. I know that you specifically have been helping some of the immigrants of late, as many of them have had problems, you know, not only with what's going on with regard to immigration, but also with the COVID virus.
Describe then the differences after you found out about the gravity of COVID and what happened in your personal life, but also in your professional life.
Well, I'll start off with the professional differences, I guess. In the very beginning, because I'm in the so-called affected, most affected age group, they were really not wanting me to come to work much, you know, and I work PRN, so, or as needed. And so that, you know, kind of slowed down a lot. I think life slowed down for a lot of people initially. And so I was home, and that actually was a little bit nice until we started feeling financial effects, you know, so, but I also am a caregiver for my parents, who are quite elderly. They're 87 and 88 and are still at home. So I'm their health care surrogate. And so for me, finding care for them, you know, one has dementia and the other has rheumatoid arthritis plus some other conditions, and trying to keep them safe with different caregivers and then caregivers not showing up and, you know, everybody was having their issues with, am I going to be exposed or expose someone or, you know, so it became really complicated, you know, trying to figure out when to work, when not to work, when to care, you know, how to care for my parents, who could be there, who couldn't, you know, what the rules were going to be. So that has continued to be really an issue.
Yeah.
So after some period of time, you know, and different agencies, governmental agencies, all those kind of things that regulate the atmosphere in long-term care facilities finally started getting their act together, then it became, okay, now we're working too much because we've got all these shortages.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, we've had one staff person to pass away from COVID.
Oh my goodness.
We've had, you know, different varying times when, you know, a group of people couldn't work. And so people have been trying to pick up other types of work that they don't normally do in the facility. You know, so it's been a lot of chaos.
Yes.
Just ongoing chaos is what I would say. And then seeing the effects on the elderly patients has just that's been really horrendous. And we've had a lot of them that they got sick from other things.
Yes.
And a lot of it was emotional, mental stresses from not being able to see their families, being isolated, because sometimes they were isolated to their room.
Yes.
For long periods of time. So you just see their decline, you know, and that's been really unfortunate, you know, because they just don't get the stimulation that they were getting before, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a mixed bag of personal and professional, but it has to do with healthcare.
Yes.
Yeah. I did a lot of trying to figure out with my healthcare ministry that there are some people that I have to take for specialty services to University of Kentucky. And hang on just a second here, Peg. Hey, Bob. Bob, could you stop that? Anyway, I'm trying to get him to quit doing the dishes in the background here. But anyway, that got, you know, as well complicated.
Of course.
You know, and so instead I found myself trying to bring them to my home so that we could get online for Zoom appointments. And then, because most of them, they don't have computer accesses or things like that, you know, and then it snowballs into the social parts of things, because you've got the kids that couldn't, you know, be at school and don't have internet access, and all of a sudden you're picking up all the social pieces, trying to figure out how to get them taken care of as well, you know.
Gosh.
So that, you know, got pretty complicated, you know. I learned a lot.
Yeah. Well, it's not easy. That idea of...
I think like all of us, we...
Go ahead.
I think we've been feeling our way through. Real guideline, you know, so you're just kind of feeling your way through, trying to get services from the state for them. Has been complicated because they can't go to their neighborhood place where they usually go. It's, you know, yeah, all of that's been a lot more difficult.
Yes. When I think back to the nursing home, a decline in death in isolation is just, that's just the most horrible part of it.
Right. Well, because most of them couldn't have, unless they were actively dying.
Yeah.
And even then, they could only have one or maybe two family members, you know, who were restricted to stay right in the room with them. So.
Don't worry about it. Life goes on, all right? This is a good interview, okay?
Yeah. So anyway, that's kind of watching all that has been really difficult. And even my siblings, who are also kind of in the healthcare field, you know, the constant thing of, should I test it again? I've been, you know, around this patient that had this, should I go get tested again? Before I can go take care of mom, I've got to go get tested. And we would find ourselves, I think I've been tested 9 or 10 times now.
Mercy.
and my sister as well, and finding ourselves even driving to Frankfurt because there were no rapid testing places in Louisville, of all things.
Of all things.
Yes. So we go to Frankfurt or Bardstown or Shepherdsville and wait. You have to, if you couldn't get an appointment, you just have to go there in the morning, early in the morning, and just wait until they could get you in.
Oh, and my goodness. That's just horrible.
That's been pretty challenging.
So, I'm sure it has. For yourself personally at home and that sort of thing, is everything good there in terms of?
Yeah. In the middle of all this, my other things go on.
Yes.
My dad's been in the hospital, and because of because of COVID, I was the designated person that could visit him through the entire stay.
Wow.
Which, because of some of his conditions, I pretty much had to be there from 10 in the morning till 7 or 8 at night every day.
My goodness.
So then
you need to be three people, Virginia.
Well, for a while it was pretty crazy.
And I then, bet.
And then my daughter-in-law's been diagnosed with breast cancer during all this. Oh, so,
how terrible. I'm so sorry.
Nobody could go with her to see the doctors, not even her husband.
That's horrible.
So that's been pretty challenging.
Yeah, I mean, these kind of emotional life issues, and you have to go suffer through it alone. That's just, I think, the most devastating part.
Right, right. And probably like you, you're always with your grandkids, you're trying to not get close. I mean, I wear my mask with them all the time. I wear my mask all the time. I'm caring for my parents, or all the time that I'm around my son and his family, because, you know, I don't feel like I can take that chance, you know.
Yeah.
So it's your distance, like not hugging, not, you know, that's pretty difficult too.
And it's hard, you know, if they're little kids, for them to understand sometimes, I think.
Right, right, exactly. You know, so. Anyway, that's, you know, and yesterday I got to try to help my grandkids with their NTI.
I'm doing that 5 days a week, Virginia. Let me tell you, I feel your pain.
Oh, I was like looking at it going, oh my gosh. You
know? Yeah.
But their mom was getting chemo, and it was like, you know.
So. Yeah. Well, it's good you were able to do that. And the first couple of times are always bumpy. After that, you can handle it for sure. All the other stuff you're doing. Tell me a little bit about, do you think this virus, this pandemic, has it been politicized?
Oh my gosh. I think in the very beginning, for probably all of a month, we were all kind of pulling together.
Yeah.
And then things went south real fast.
Yeah.
You know, it was just, I really don't know. I think there was just enough time there. All these people are at home, and you're finding out that just from stuff that people would post or repost or whatever on, I don't have Facebook, but I watch my husband's and I get emails, but the stuff that people would repost was pretty shocking, you know, people that you thought you knew.
Yes.
And all of a sudden you're like, oh my gosh. I mean, I had friends even saying, I never knew that your brother really thought X, Y, and Z. I had to unfriend him, you know.
Oh gosh.
Like, yeah, well, you know.
Yes.
You know, this, so I think there's been the whole wear a mask, don't wear a mask thing.
Yeah.
That has caused some super divisions. And I mean, inside families, inside, and then pretty much how people land on that gives you a pretty good idea about their political views.
Yeah, exactly.
Where they're getting information, you know?
Yeah, well, it's even been used against Biden, the campaign, to say that if he gets to be president, he will mandate masks. Oh, no.
Oh, my. You know, it's such a social taking away your rights. I was like, your right to what? Not make somebody else sick, or your right to not get sick? Or
exactly. I mean, my rights stop basically at, you know, where you are, your person, and when I'm spewing out virus particles. I mean, I don't have the right to do that.
Yeah, right. It has really just been beyond my wildest imagination that
Me too.
Would go into such a independent my rights stance on something that affects everyone.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and as you said, you've got social media, you've got things like Fox News, you know, blaring, spewing out this, you know, the kind of rhetoric that, you know, makes people want to take sides. You know, it's just a horrible combination, isn't it?
Right. I don't know. I mean, we've had family members sending us, you know, posts of, even of, black talk show hosts who are against, this is in the racial justice arena, but
yeah,
who are against the black people, blaming the black people who were murdered. Oh. And we're like, where did you find this? Where,
no,
you know,
kidding.
It's pretty incredible.
There's an awful lot in the swamps of social media that you just don't want to know anything about.
Well, I can't spend too much time there, that's for sure.
Me either. Tell me a little bit, I'll talk about the different governmental levels. In terms of locally, how has COVID been handled? You've already talked about the inability to get testing done.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, yeah, the lack of rapid testing in Louisville, it seems to me to be just unfathomable, because here we are, the largest concentration of people in the state.
Yeah.
And yet we have to go to these rural areas to get a rapid test. That, you know, because the testing itself is so delayed. I mean, sometimes it takes a week to get a result.
Yeah.
Well, you know, is that a week that you're not supposed to work? You don't know. Is that a week that you need to isolate yourself? You're not really sure. You know, it's that, to me, the delay has been really difficult. And it varies all over the map. I mean, like, people that are going to have some kind of procedure, they can get their test results back in 2 days or 3 days, while other people are going, you know, 2 weeks. You know, so real inconsistent, you know. Yeah.
What about the state level and the governor?
Well, I really think that our governor has tried, has given it his best. And to me, it, you know, in the amount of time that it took for people to get organized to protest, it was like he was being assaulted all the time, and I don't even know how he stood up to that. You know, the effigies on his lawn. And one thing that was so curious to me is how protesters could take assault weapons, high-powered weapons, onto his property, onto the federal, I mean, not federal, but onto the state government property, inside the buildings, and that's okay. But whenever I've been there to protest with no weapons, we've been told we couldn't come into the building. And that to me is like, it just speaks of the law enforcement being tied to these, I don't know if I want to call them white supremacy groups. I think a lot of them are, but whatever their ilk is, it seems to me like those two are tied together, the law enforcement, especially sheriffs, sheriffs. And that, I mean, I've just seen that firsthand for myself when I've been in Frankfort demonstrating. And that's just unacceptable. And this made it that much worse, you know. Yeah.
Well, but the updates the governor was able to give, I mean, just the daily meetings, I mean, those have been very valuable, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and then, you know, after they've been spread into so many other areas of government, you know, new legislation that they're under consideration, all kinds of things, you know, because there's people there asking questions every day. And I would love to see that even continue once the COVID is gone, because that's very informative.
Well, that's the kind of government of the people that you really want.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. You want to talk a little bit about the national level?
Oh, boy. Poor Dr. Fauci.
Poor Dr. Fauci, indeed.
Oh, my word. I understand that he feels like he needs to try to stay there to, you know, represent the CDC and all that, but it seems there is so much interference, much interference. He can't even give a straight line to, you know, it's don't wear a mask, do wear a mask, you know. And I know that there is some amount of just lack of knowledge about this particular virus, but you know, I think it was pretty clear from the beginning that masks were one of the measures that would help slow down the spread, you know, but the backlash was just from the president down, and that, of course, I've never been a fan of his, but then this has just been unbelievable. You know, some of the bad information that he's just put out there, you know, I mean, people getting sick because they're doing what he just spouts off about. Maybe we could drink bleach.
Yeah.
Or hydrochloroquine or and I, you know, it just is put lights inside of us. What?
Yeah.
You're just like, it's the level of ignorance is just beyond the pale.
You know? Well, and a lot of it, don't you think, is about the election in terms of he wants to have a virus by November, that sort of thing, even despite the fact that they aren't able to do adequate testing and placebo, you know, studies on certain
things. I heard him talk about, well, just to give you an example, I was on the phone for an extended conversation with someone from the National Cancer Institute the other day, and I was talking to them about a mushroom derivative. It comes from a mushroom called turkey tail, which they've done phase one studies on for breast cancer at Bastyr University and the Canadian National Health Institute. Mm-hmm. And so I was talking to her about that because honestly, I got it from my daughter-in-law to take because I've been following the work of this mycologist for years.
Yes.
Dr. Paul Stamets. So, but of course she had to give the government federal response from the National Institute of Health, which was it takes 8 years to get a medication or a vaccine approved because it has to go through all these trials. And that was 2 days ago that I talked to her. And now all of a sudden we're going to get a vaccine approved in, what, 6 months?
Yeah.
I mean, 6 or 7 months. I mean, that's incredible. And then they wonder why people wouldn't trust it.
Yeah.
You know.
Exactly. Exactly.
And how many times have there been mistakes? That's the other thing, is they'll approve. I mean, this is talking about a vaccine, but they'll approve a medication get it all the way through all these trials, all the phases of all these long-term trials. Uh-huh. And then 10 years down the road, they found out, oh, we didn't know it was going to cause this.
Yeah.
It's just like hormone therapy for women. You know?
Oh, yes, I remember that well.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it's no wonder that people don't trust, because they drag their feet on the things that would be beneficial. And then when there's money to be made on some medicine, it seems to kind of get through there pretty quick.
Yes.
So you understand why people, you know, aren't going to trust it.
Yeah. One, this vaccine they're talking about coming out by the end of the year, they're just going to give it to healthcare workers and first responders at first. I know, I was thinking, mm-hmm. are they the guinea pigs? I mean, I do think they need the protection quickly, but if this is not thoroughly tested, the last people I want to give it to are the people that are taking care of everybody. It's just right. very confused times, and everybody's got an agenda.
Well, now, yeah, they want to release it, what, the 1st or 2nd of November?
Of course, because November 3rd is the election.
You know, it's like, you know, the savior, you know, as he says, only I can. Oh. I was like, you know, he's got such a, I wouldn't even begin to say how many different diagnoses he has.
Yeah.
But there's a few. There's definitely a few.
Just roll out the old DSM. Page by page.
Oh my gosh.
All right. Virginia, has anything good happened in your life as a result of the virus?
Well, like I was saying in the beginning, you know, everything kind of slowed down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a couple of projects at home that we had been like putting off for years.
Yeah.
So landscaped, we are still in the process of landscaping our house, which desperately needed something done.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we kind of have been doing that, you know, because we would normally be, my husband's a musician, so we would normally be out hearing people play music and getting together with people that way. And all of that's been really nixed. So, you know, spending more time at home, definitely, you know.
Yes.
And that has its good sides. So less, fewer meetings.
Yes.
Do some Zoom meetings, but fewer.
Yeah.
And that it, I think this is partly because of my age, but I guess I have more difficulty really staying focused on a Zoom. You know, whatever the work is that you were doing, like I belong to the group that's been working on the 100% renewable energy.
Yes.
For the city. And it, thank God it got passed in February, because if it had come in March or April.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it would have been delayed again, you know. So anyway, that it's been difficult for me to kind of stay engaged, you know, just doing everything on Zoom, you know.
Yes. But yes.
I think that's partly my age and partly that I was born in the wrong century.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, there are a lot of Zoom meetings, certainly, but it does work pretty well. I mean, you know, I don't want to get over Zoom, don't get me wrong, but for example, for church, it's been a fabulous venue, hasn't it?
It has. I think it has allowed there to be a lot more people than would normally come, and from all over, you know, some from out of the country, and, you know, all of those people definitely would not have been able to have, you know, engaged otherwise.
Are you pretty comfortable with the format, Virginia?
For the church's Zoom meeting?
For the bread service, yeah.
Yeah, I did the survey that they sent out. I mean, I think that a couple of things that, and I noticed this Sunday that they kind of were doing this, so I might not have been the only person that suggested it, but I thought that they needed to put a little bit more emphasis on the actual bread service
part. I agree. I said the same thing.
Yeah, and then, I really, really miss the announcements at the end of church, you know, end of the service.
Well, you know, if we can do prayers of the faithful, we ought to be able to have announcements, don't you think?
That's what I said.
I didn't mention that, but that I agree with that. I asked them to put back in the Sanctus and the Lamb of God. I missed that. Because that's
well, kind you of know, there's it's a different right. And it's a different thing to read, you know, just read a, you know, down the e-bulletin, read a list of things.
Yeah.
You know, rather than somebody really engaging with why this is important.
Yes.
You know, or at least why it's important to them and why it might be important to you, you know.
Well, I bet Don could get that done with, you know, the hand-raising thing that they use on the prayers of the faithful. Because I'm like you, it does mean a lot more when somebody like you does the outreach and describes something.
Yeah, I think, you know, that it's just that whether it's one-on-one or one-on with a group, you know, but it in person is a lot more effective for those type of things, you know, so.
Well, that brings up something I wanted to ask you about anyway, and that is, you know, at St. William's, our sign of peace goes on for many, many minutes, and it's very loving, it's very touchy, and that sort of thing. And that just brings up the whole idea of personal touch, the physical contact. You know, I've talked to several people that are living alone, and a couple of them just broke down when they talked about it. You know, it's a hard thing to get used to, not doing a handshake or a hug or a pat. When it's not important to everybody, but it's important to most people.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it's a matter of health, your health. You need that. You know, people need that. And, you know, and the other thing is that now you're in this constant state of when you are with somebody trying to stop yourself from showing affection, you know, or stop yourself from doing. And I'm just wondering what the impact of that's going to be long term.
Oh,
you know,
I agree.
Even when people are allowed to go back, you know, if now there's just this sense of everybody's got their own germ space, you know, their own bacterial space, you know, and you're always going to be trying to stay distant, you know.
Yeah, but it's going to be, I mean, it's because it's being, you know, pounded into us. I mean, a lot of people said, you know, I'm not going to be as anxious to shake a stranger's hand or hug somebody I don't really know. So it's going to have a long-term effect, probably.
Right. And especially if you're someone that's working with marginalized people, they're not always really clean. They're not always, you know, in the best of health. You know, those.
Absolutely.
And yet those are the people that really need the contact more than anybody.
Absolutely. Well, I think about your patients in the nursing home. One of the things they spiral down with when they don't have that kind of physical contact.
Well, it's not really just the physical contact. They have so much less mobility.
Yeah.
Because they've been isolated to their rooms. And even, you know, there's been times that we say, well, you can walk this hallway, the length of this hallway, as long as there's not more than two people in it.
Oosh.
Well, you know, if... when they used to be able to get out and walk and do, you know, so just the lack of exercise and mobility has just, been pretty devastating.
Yes. I'm sure people that were doing fairly well, that's been a spiral downward for them.
Oh, yeah.
That's so sad.
And then if they go to the doctor or go out to the hospital and then they come back, they've got to be isolated for 14 days.
Oh.
Like, oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh. That's just horrible. That's just horrible.
We've had some of them say, I'm not going to go to the doctor if I have to do that.
You know? I don't blame them. I can understand that because the isolation is the worst thing.
Right.
Virginia, think about like 50 to 100 years from now when historians are going to analyze this period and write history books and history textbooks, that sort of thing. What do you think will be their take on it?
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of analysis of why we were so unprepared.
Yes.
You know, of course, you and I know that that there have been suggestions all the way back to George W. Bush, who actually pushed for pandemic preparedness.
Yes.
You know, whether you like him or not, that was one of the things that he really did do, was push for that.
And yes.
And then, you know, it just got eroded, you know, I think, you know, in the bigger picture, it's going to be whenever the perpetual growth economy model took over everything. And so anything that wasn't going to make a profit in a short amount of time was just not valued.
Yeah.
And that's really going to be kind of a, you know, an evaluation of when the society became so self-focused on what's good for me is the most important, and, you know, and the cost of caring for everyone else, that's not my problem. You know, everybody's very, you know, contained in silos, and it's, you know, I shouldn't say everybody, but that segment of the population has become more and more pronounced. And I think they've been given permission to not think about the common good and to not, you know, maybe it's an American, it's been there all along, you know, that self-righteous, pull yourself up by the bootstrap kind of thing is ridiculous. I mean, it was ridiculous from the beginning, but, you know, it's just gotten so much stronger.
Yeah. Well, especially with the income distribution being what it is right now, just these few people at the top have all the money power. It's incredible.
Yeah. Well, and it's all about protecting them too.
Oh, yeah.
Protecting their interest over and above everything else. You know,
we always value this idea of American individualism, but in a lot of ways, that is not really a good thing to think about right now. I mean, we need to be concerned about each other.
Well, you know, if you want to think about the environment, I mean, that's, you know, that's where it really comes down to. I mean, that we've, you know, it's all a resource for our personal use.
Yes.
And collectively, there isn't a common good, you know. I mean, they could say, oh, well, you know, all of these inventions of, you know, the automobile or whatever, but there were always other options that were healthier that were overridden by the money interest.
Yeah. You know, well, even if you go back to the 1920s, when we wedded ourselves to the automobile, we tossed out the railroads and that sort of thing, even the trolleys downtown here, you know, in favor of, you know, individuals being in their automobiles.
Well, you know, the original cars were going to be able to run on alcohol made from corn fuel and all of that. You know, farmers were going to be able to make their own fuel to run their tractors. And that was going to be the original model for the car. And it was Standard Oil that came in and said, oh no, we found this oil. And
good old J.D. Rockefeller.
Yep. So, you know, that's been going on for a long time, but now we are paying the piper, you know.
This other idea is of American exceptionalism. Mm-hmm. We've heard that term, that we've got the best of everything. And it is just so untrue.
Mm. No, we have probably, I mean, for a supposedly civilized first world country, our healthcare doesn't stand up at all.
Yeah.
It just does not, you know, and so you know, when they say, when I was talking to the National Cancer Institute person, and, you know, she said, well, you know, it's just because the regulations of the FDA are so stringent that some of these things that they're using in other countries, you know, that we can't do it here. And I'm like, no, no, it's about making money, you know? So that's the real discouraging part to me, is that it's the economy, in quotes, has become God, and in the whole capitalist idea of economy, you know, there is nothing that grows forever. Nothing.
Yes.
And so to have a model that is supposed to sustain constant growth is ridiculous, especially on a finite planet.
So. Yeah. Well, I was reading today about the National Health Program in England, where they are so organized in terms of testing, in terms of, you know, looking for the proper virus, the proper vaccine. And you compare that to the United States, where everything is splintered and unorganized and competitive to the hilt. Mm-hmm. I mean, how we think that's exceptional is beyond my understanding.
No, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I don't. You know, it is so ingrained, though, that I have to tell you this. This is kind of a statement about Catholicism, one of the parts of it that I'm not very happy about. Hmm. But I told you that yesterday I was doing homework or NTI assignments with my second grader, and he had religion, and they're preparing for reconciliation. And so they had a video on that you are blessed, okay, and gratitude, and those things were fine, except that they started listing I'm blessed because I have good vision, I'm blessed, you know, they went through the five senses, you know, well, all that's okay, but it ended up by saying you are blessed because you live in a country with liberty and justice. You are blessed because you have clean air and water. Well, what's the converse of that?
Yeah.
If you're blessed because you have clean air and water and you have liberty and justice, what does that say about the people who do not have clean air and water and don't live in a country with liberty and justice?
Even if you question whether we do or not.
Exactly, exactly. And all of the characters in this animated thing were white children.
Gosh. And I'm like the Baltimore Catechism, Virginia.
Well, guess where it was? St. Margaret Mary.
Well.
You know, and I mean, there were a whole lot of other things in there that I was just appalled with. You know, I thought, you know what, this is how we brainwash into classism.
Yes.
You know, everybody's supposed to have what I have, and if they don't, then there's something wrong with them. They're not, my God. I was beside myself by the time I finished this, you know, 10-minute video with my grandson.
Yeah.
So
as the second grader, they're just coating his brain with that, basically.
Well, I had to tell him, now, Gabriel, now we're going to have a conversation about this.
You know, so. You sound like Paul Harvey. Now we'll hear the rest of the story.
I was like, this is module number 6. I've missed 1 through 5. Okay.
What else has been put into his brain?
I know. And my daughter-in-law is not. She grew up in Eastern Kentucky in a household that hated Catholics. So now her kids are in Catholic school, and she's having a hard time with it. And
well, I guess so.
You know, let's look at this. And then, you know, why do you wonder, you know?
Exactly. Exactly.
Anyway, that's
a good segue into something else, though. Well, let's talk a little bit about the pandemic within the pandemic. The racial unrest. Virginia, do you think that it's in any way related to the virus?
Well, I think that I don't think the incidences that initiated all of the protesting necessarily had to do with the virus.
Yeah. Like the death of George Floyd and the murder of Breonna Taylor.
Right, right. But, you know, we all know that the health status of people that live in Black and Brown communities is much worse, that their outcomes are much worse, that they are affected by the COVID so much worse. They're affected by environmental injustice much worse.
Much worse.
Much, much worse. And so, you know, I think it's been a powder keg sitting there waiting to blow.
Yeah.
And now, you know, of course, with all of the people can, you know, videotape and post all these
things. That's a big deal. That's a big deal. For sure.
Have been. I mean, it's not that these things weren't happening.
Yeah.
It's just that, and even with Breonna Taylor's case, look how long it took for the city to really realize what was going on there. You know,
when you see in today's paper, they were trying to use her ex-boyfriend to try to incriminate her.
Right, right. And then, of course, they said, no, we didn't ever really offer him that. But the fact that it was written in a draft at all was,
yes,
like, okay, go back to what we always do and blame the victims.
Yes. You
know? And the other thing was that I said, you know, people wanted to point to George Floyd and say he wasn't a real role, you know, he wasn't a perfect citizen. And Breonna wasn't a perfect citizen. And I said, no matter what.
No matter what.
It doesn't make a hill of beans difference. They don't deserve to die. You know, that's not the way we do things. You know, it's like, but apparently it is. You know, and that's what's disturbing about it all.
Yeah. Well, I mean, also people are, they're out of work. They wonder where their next paycheck is coming or whether they can feed their kids. I mean, the stresses right now, I think, lend themselves to that powder keg, don't you think?
Well, I think that plus right now, you know, just like where I live, the crime rate, it is going up, you know, but it's the carjackings, you know, triple what they were last year. But those are a lot of economic, you know, outliers. I mean, not outliers. They're economic
indicators.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it doesn't take much to, whenever somebody's already under financial constraint to just say, well, the hell with it. You know, I'll just go steal the car so I can get to X, Y, or Z, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's, I think there's a lot of stress and to some degree people have, it's almost like there's been a permission given to act out.
Yeah.
In some ways on both sides of the equation, I think there's been some permission to act out because, you know, on one side they're saying, you know, I've been suppressed for all this time, you know, I'm just going to take what I should have had.
Yeah.
You know, and on the other side, you know, saying, you know, we've got to keep you down at no matter what cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't know. That's
well, and this term defund the police has been really used as something that's just a big scare tactic.
Mm-hmm.
When I think what they're looking at is reallocating funds and making sure that there's social workers and mental health professionals that are part of this whole process and
mm-hmm.
stop the idea of being a warrior against the people.
Right, right. Well, here's the other piece of it. I mean, I worked at the VA for 24 years. And to me, you know, when you've got people who are trained to kill, you know, to put it politely, that they are trained to be warriors, and then they try to come back into a civilian setting.
Yeah.
And often they end up in police departments or sheriff's departments or they end up in militia groups.
Yes.
You know, or because they've got a predisposition to that way of thinking. And so already you've got groups, and now they're saying that even the white supremacy groups have been infiltrating the police departments, you know. So to me,
well, it's happened in Germany. Why couldn't it happen here? I mean, you know, they've got that problem there. Yeah.
So I mean, I haven't. The issue is that in a crisis, in a moment of danger, you want to be able to call the police.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you are fearful. I mean, there was a period of time when I was being stalked for about 5 years.
Wow.
And every time there would be something really threatening, dangerous, or whatever, and I called the police, I mean, half the time their response to me was, you must have done something.
Yeah, right.
To provoke this. You know, it was a very demeaning response. Uh-huh. And so I can only imagine if I were a Black woman or Hispanic, you know, how that would have been. But, you know, I haven't, even as a white person, trusted the police for a long time. Yeah. You know, I was afraid for my girls when they were teenagers that they would get pulled over and something happened to them. You know, there was, you know, so.
No, well, I think now people are seeing, I mean, I would bet you the store that called the police on George Floyd never thought for a second something like that would happen.
Oh, right. Right.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, it's the crazy thing is, and I don't know if this is really true, but apparently George Floyd and that policeman that knelt on his neck knew each other.
Well, it would be hard to think they didn't, since they worked at the same nightclub.
Yeah.
George Floyd was a bouncer and the other guy, Sholin, did security. And there is some speculation that there was a point where George Floyd was giving out the paychecks and Chauvin wasn't satisfied with him. And there was some sort of, you know, between the two of them. So you have to think that that's going to come out eventually. But you know what? You're the first person that's mentioned that to me. Sometimes I think, did I really read that? But no, that's really true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, sometimes there's this whole revenge thing.
Oh yeah.
And you've got the whole thing of mob mentality as well. Yeah. And that affects police as well as protesters. Okay, sorry.
Life goes on, Virginia.
Yeah, my sister wanted to talk about my parents, I'm sure. So
yeah. So I guess we'll go to the last question. That is, you know, after the acute phase dies down, and we talked about this a little bit, and maybe we have a vaccine, what do you think the new normal will look like, Virginia?
Oh, well, like we were saying before, I think people are going to be a lot more guarded. And I think that a lot of more people are going to be working from home. You know, then people are going to be taking second looks at how much of their life energy and lifetime does their job take.
Yeah.
Do I still want that same kind of scenario? You know.
Yeah.
So I think it has caused people to really question their, you know, where, how they use their time, how they spend their time, and what's really important to them.
Yeah.
That whole idea of, you know, you could get sick and just be gone that quickly.
Oh, you know? Yeah, absolutely. And you've seen that more than anybody, I'm sure.
Well, the whole, I think America as a whole has always, has not ever dealt well with death.
Yeah.
You know, and this kind of put it in your face in real time, in, you know, large numbers, younger people as well as older people, you know, and that, you know, I think that will affect people's thinking. My brother-in-law is a lawyer, and he said the rush of people trying to get wills done has been incredible.
I just imagine. Wow. You
know, so, you know, I think it has really brought to people's mind how vulnerable they really are.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Virginia, is there anything else you'd like to talk about or say to have on the record?
I think that hopefully we're going to take a really good long look at our healthcare systems, the inequity of them, in one sense, and the just how people can be broken by just trying to cover their healthcare costs, how unequal it is. I mean, I'm hoping that there's going to be some kind of a healthcare system that covers everyone, you know.
Well, thank you for a fantastic interview. This is one of the best. I really appreciate it.
Well, I hope you can get something out of it that's worth it.
Just talking to you was really worthy. Thank you so much.
Well, you too. You take care. Thanks.
You too, Virginia. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.